As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'ma roll with what I'm giving. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going, better go in the right direction. In the moment you stressing, but you gon' be counting blessings. And I know that for certain, keep on working, open curtains. Haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. I'm never gon' give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah.
You're listening to the Tom Ficklin Show on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, your home for community radio.
Good morning, New Haven. I'm Tom Thurston. And first, I want to thank my friend Tom Ficklin for giving me the opportunity to fill in for him. Tom's recovering well. And just yesterday, he sent me a really kind of important reminder that today, August 23rd, is the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition, which was set forward by UNESCO to memorialize the transatlantic slave trade. And the reason that it's set aside on August 23rd is because it was the night of the 22nd and into the 23rd that the island of Saint-Domingue, an uprising began that eventually leads to the revolution in Haiti, the first and only country where the enslaved rose up and overthrew their enslavers and formed the nation of Haiti. So let's remember that, and let's remember the sacrifice and the heroism of the people of Haiti for bringing freedom to the Atlantic world. This is one of the most kind of pivotal moments in the history of the Atlantic world. And honestly, it isn't talked about nearly often enough and with that sort of emphasis. I'm the Director of Education and Public Outreach for the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. And today we're going to be talking about the Yale and Slavery Research Project, which was established just last year by President Peter Salovey to really investigate the role, the responsibility, the associations that Yale University has had with individuals and as an institution in promoting slavery, anti-Black racism, other forms of exploitation, to understand and explore that history, including its most difficult aspects, to see what the institution's ties are to slavery and racism, and to research, understand, analyze, and communicate that history. And, you know, I'm really fortunate to have with us three people that have been are part of that research committee. And the findings of the committee are not yet released, and that's going to be happening within the next several months. I think you'll be hearing a lot more about this in the immediate future, but we're going to get a little preview this morning. And with that, I want to introduce our three panelists. First, Tiana Reed, who is a joint PhD student in history and African American studies. Her dissertation project explores the hidden economic activities of enslaved and free people of color in Barbados, Jamaica, and South Carolina from 1670 to 1770. And as you can imagine, her focus on the research project is really on the kind of the early years of Yale, the 18th century and into the 19th century. So she'll be focusing on that, although I must say that all of our speakers have, just by nature of the research they're doing, have developed a real broad understanding, I think, of Yale, New Haven, and the role that enslaved and free people of color play in that. Next, we'll be hearing from Christy Charnel, who is going to be a third-year student at Yale Divinity School, where her studies lie at the intersection of theology, medicine, and anti-Blackness. And honestly, I don't think you could be a better place than the Div School, but also Yale University in general. There's so much work going on around, in particular, medicine and the social construction of the Black body, and that there's some wonderful people that I'm sure you're familiar with. And Christy will be focusing predominantly on just that question. What was the role of the Divinity School? What was the role of pastors, reverends, both slaveholders and abolitionists and their connection with Yale? And then finally, my friend Charles Warner Jr., New Haven, born and raised, graduate of the New Haven Public Schools, and then off to Atlanta for his studies in sociology at Morehouse College. He's currently a behavior specialist in the New Haven Public Schools. He works with staff and students in the area of social and emotional learning and student support services. Charles is really active in community work. He's the chairman of the Connecticut Freedom Trail Commission, as well as a member of the board of directors of the Amistad Committee Incorporated, and the chairman of the Dixwell Congregational Church's History Committee. So, Chaz, it's really great to have you with us as well. And so, Tiana, if I may, I'd love to kind of start off with you, and if we could talk a little about the kind of work that you're doing with the research project.
Yeah, so I'm primarily focused and tasked with looking at Yale and slavery in the 18th century and a little bit of the 17th century as well. Also picking up information on Elihu Yale falls under sort of my umbrella and bucket. So late 17th and the bulk of the 18th century, looking at the early Yalees, trustees, faculty, students, and slave ownership amongst them, but also trying to find the names of those enslaved people and who they were, and seeing if we can find out more information about their lives as they were either maybe working for students or faculty, or working to help build the college. We found quite a bit of enslaved people were involved in the process of building Connecticut Hall, and we will have more information coming out about that. And so looking at the labor that went into actually building the university, that's been one area that we've uncovered some information about how exactly that happened. But then also in terms of the financing of the university, that's sort of been one of the big things. How has the slave trade and slavery contributed to putting money into the university? And so it's been fascinating to uncover this information and to really see the relationship between Yale and slavery, but also Yale and New Haven and the state of Connecticut. And very much what's been important in this time period has been the fact that it's a colony. New Haven is still right. Part of the colony of Connecticut. Connecticut's a colony. And so this imperial lens and making sure to contextualize that has been one of the ways we found all of these connections, because historically Connecticut doesn't have it's not the South. It doesn't have hundreds of enslaved people on plantations, but that doesn't mean that it didn't benefit from slavery and the money that was made from slavery and things like that. So it's been very important. I think the sort of angle that I bring in from my own research is, when you know the pieces and how the empire worked in that time period, the British Empire at that time, and how the colonies fit within the mercantilist system and all of that, and how the slave trade was economically important in that time, you can see these connections and you can find and look in different areas. And that really sort of distinguishing our work, at least in the 18th century, from other projects. And sort of in terms of other projects, most of them haven't really tackled the 18th century. It's kind of seemed like there's nothing there, but there's actually a lot when you know how to, navigate the archives and dig for information and those connections.
Well, I mean, certainly, I think you're right, everything you say. And while I'm sure our listeners are fully aware that there were enslaved people in New Haven, both as a colony and as, the early Republic days, is that I think, as you say, what often goes, like unmentioned or not really thought about as much as the role that, the Connecticut, all of the New England colonies are playing in provisioning slavery in the Caribbean, processing produce that's coming from the Caribbean and then being shipped to the British Empire, and the fortunes that are made through those processes. Could you say a little more just about some of the people at Yale in particular who really benefited in either directly or in this indirect kind of provisioning trade from this?
Yeah, so in one of the people that we're looking at or that have come up, so Governor Stalton, who was very important in sort of establishing Yale in New Haven. So originally Yale was in Saybrook, and the college moves over. The Stalton family is involved in the slave trade long term, but also Governor Stalton, his son comes to Yale. That's a part of the sort of like colony pushing for the survival of the institution. He owned an enslaved person himself, and then also he donated to the college. So there is all these kind of layers of how, you know, the slave trade, the son who went here would be a part of that, and how the family in multiple generations is connected to slavery, and then their relationship to Yale then also entangles the university in the slave trade and profits from slavery. So that's just one example of someone who's really prominent, especially in the early days. Governor Stalton writes to Elihu Yale to help get him to donate. And so that's part of how the college will eventually become Yale College. So pretty big guy as far as his contributions to those early days of the Yale College. Yeah, that's one example, not just of one individual, but sort of that family that will, you know, keep a connection to Yale and then keep a connection to slavery and then entangle the university in that relationship.
And I imagine that kind of, in other words, the capital that is, you know, from which people draw money to fund Yale is, it would be hard to, that capital is accumulated in one way or another through slavery, because this is really the economic engine, especially for those of us in, you know, in the new world, but that is really driving everything else. But the other thing you mentioned that I'd love to hear more about are the enslaved people that you're kind of finding. And what do you know about them? How and where are you finding information? Are they just right now names on a ledger, or have you been able to kind of dig deeper and find out more about their lives and their families and perhaps their descendants?
Yeah. So far, it's been because there's just so little research previously done on the 18th century. It's been about going back to those wills or those runaway ads and those kinds of documents and trying to match the names of the mentioned enslaved people to the Yale personnel that we believe they're connected to. So for right now, we just really have, we've been just gathering the names that we can find of those enslaved people, people like Pompey, people like George, people like enslaved women like Lily. And so they're connected to various trustees, early Yale students, reverends that I will, you know, put that to Christy later on, some of the reverends who graduate from the university or college at that point. They also have enslaved people. And so that becomes a longer story of some conflict later on with whether or not you know, reverends should have enslaved people and abolitionist sentiment later on in the 18th century. But at least in the beginning, there's quite a bit of slave ownership amongst the early Yale staff and personnel. And so finding those names, finding those people, and then hopefully as the project goes along, seeing if we can find their family or what happens to them. So far, it's been difficult trying to find enslaved people in early Connecticut. The records aren't particularly great. The other thing that's not necessarily helping either for the enslavers or the enslaved people is the repetitiveness of names. A lot of people have the same name. So then there's a lot to make sure that we are matching the correct people on both ends. So the research is pretty rigorous to make sure that, you know, when we're saying this person owned this enslaved person and this is where they went on to, you know, we can be pretty certain of that. We have found one free person, Jethro Luke, who's there's a whole sort of a presentation on that available through the Beinecke. I think he's one of the more fleshed out stories that we have to some degree. There's still more work to be done even on Jethro Luke and the piece of property that he owned. But we know he worked on Connecticut College and he was employed by the university in the 18th century. And so, we're using a sort of variety of methods to try to figure out who were these enslaved people. And then a sort of smaller contingent even within that are the enslaved Native Americans that are part of this story, that there are a few of them as well who are owned in the earlier part of the 18th century. So really trying to connect those dots. And, you know, that's why the research is still ongoing in some of
these. It's been less than a year that kind of officially we've started this project. And clearly, while we will be releasing something within the next couple of months, that this is, you know, this is preliminary research that all of you are doing, and including into the 20th century and those stories. I mean, I've been hearing stories from you at Yale that I've just never heard of before, that I think are really coming, straight from the archives. It's really exciting. And I think for any of you out there are interested in kind of dipping your toes in this kind of world of research, there's plenty still to be done. These, in some ways, we're creating some signposts to kind of take you on your way, but there's always more to kind of discover in this. And when we get to you, Charles, the work that you've been doing is a great example of that. But let me go to Christy for a moment. And Charles, do you want to respond? I know that as I said in introducing you, you know, you're part of the New Haven community, and you're involved with Dixwell, with the Dixwell Church, which has a long distinguished pedigree. And, you know, you work on church history there as well as just general New Haven history. You're with the Freedom Trail Project. What's your kind of thoughts about, you know, what this process looks like now and going forward?
I think it's a great launching ground for further research, but I think the most appealing thing for me is being able to take history that sometimes doesn't make it into like university archives or Connecticut State Libraries, but are really pivotal pieces to making a full story. And a lot of times for African-American history, you will have to go to, homes or historical Black institutions that might hold on to their own information. And so I'm happy because I've been able to bring a lot of information that Black New Haven has had, or some of the older Black institutions. And honestly, in a place like New Haven, and it's probably true across America for Black communities, the oldest institutions a lot of times are the churches. Because of segregation, you know, the churches are one-stop shops for Black life. Your social would be there. Your early educational opportunities would have been available there. Health and medical was provided through the church. So a lot of these churches were institutional, what they call institutional churches. And Dixwell, the history of Temple Street Church and Dixwell Church is the same way. And so people who helped to found and foster that Dixwell Church, which is now 201 years old, tie into the Yale and slavery story, either through service to professors and or personnel at Yale, working at Yale in service capacities, and surprisingly, a huge part of the story that I want to share as early Black Yale students.
Yeah, thanks. And I mean, I think what you say about the Black Church, I mean, its role as an institutional role in the community is so important. I know when you and I were working on the William Lanson statue and all the kind of research behind that, I was always so, you know, amazed at the materials that are there in the archives of the Dixwell Congregational Church. You know, Lanson was a member, and, you know, I mean, there are these resources that have been treasured and cared for by Dixwell and the other churches in New Haven.
Sure. And Tom, I'd just like to mention, outside of Dixwell, there are some other old Black churches like Varick Memorial AME Zion Church, which is currently located right across the street from Dixwell Church, and it's on the Connecticut Freedom Trail. But they traced their founding to 1818. So Dixwell formally records their founding as 1820, although there was prior work before the official founding date. So Varick, you know, has an old history as well. And they fit into the story. St. Luke's Episcopal Church fits into the story. And the relationship, honestly, between the university and the town and the powers that be in the town, the white powers that be historically, and the Black community. You know, Yale not only was a learning institution, but really created a leadership group that ran the city, the state, and the country. Christy, did you want to hop in and talk a bit about your research?
Yeah, sure. So thank you once again for allowing me to be here. I've had the opportunity this summer to work with the 18th and 19th century group in the Yale Slavery Working Group, where I've been able to uncover and pretty much look at Yale's relationship to religion and theology in New Haven in general. As we know, Yale, the way it was created, was meant to be a seminary for preachers at its foundational core. And even in general, this New Haven colony, the founders of the colony really had in mind for it to be a form of like a theocracy. So we see that like theology and religion has a big role with Yale and its formation and the ideology that it purports during the early 18th century, 19th century. And we even see the ramifications and implications of it till this day. So pretty much I had the opportunity to research the different Yale ministers that were coming out of Yale during this time period, the different sermons that they were publishing, the different work that they were doing, and just seeing the relationship between religion, theology, Yale, slavery, and more. I was able to find in a lot of like sermons and reading like this idea of like Christianizing Black people and indigenous folks as well. This idea that they're very much they're barbaric and they're needing of evangelicalism and being able to be tamed and civilized. And that was a lot of the outlook and the role of like religion during this time period towards Black people and theology. And so, yeah, I was able to like just delve into that, kind of get an understanding of Yale and New Haven, just like you were saying, Charles. It was very much like together. It wasn't really separate. It's very much a one and more, like together, working together. I think nowadays there's kind of like this pseudo separation between Yale and New Haven, but we very much know they're integrated. But it was very much one, and the role of these congregational churches, like the First Church of Christ on the Green, and all the three like big churches on the Green, they play a role on what was going on at Yale. The different leaders at Yale, such as like for example, the first divinity professor, Professor Nathaniel Taylor, he was a minister at First Church of Christ. And there was very much this dual relationship between the congregational churches and Yale and the different theologies that was purporting in both places. And also, like, if there was any critiques or any, like, debates and such, it'd be going through these different channels for the most part. But yeah, something I was looking at.
Well, I think it's interesting because when I hear you both talk, so much of the project is a through line right from the 18th century, even until today. And I think that's one of the most interesting pieces because a lot of what I'm researching ties into what you both are researching and overlaps, especially with the influence of the Congregational Church on like the ideologies about slavery and freedom. And then with them going on to help found many of the historically Black colleges and universities that appear right at the end of the Civil War. And so, you know, my area of research in the study of the 19th century and into the 20th is really about adding some names and some life stories to the ledgers and to the lists. And so, again, we talked about the relationship also with the impact on Native Americans that were around. Well, one of the stories in particular that I really want to highlight in the final story and that's come out in the research is the story of one of Yale's distinguished graduates who had actually been enslaved as a young man. And his name is Thomas Nelson Baker. And he was enslaved in Virginia as a young man. And then eventually at about 21 years old was able to make his way to Hampton Institute. And from being at Hampton, he established a close relationship with General Armstrong, who was leading the institution at the time. And through his relationship with General Armstrong and Congregationalists, he was able to make his way to Mount Hermon School and then on to Boston University, where he graduated at the top of his class. And then from Boston, he went to Yale and earned 2 degrees. And he earned a bachelor's. He earned a second bachelor's through the Divinity School, but he also earned a PhD in 1903, I believe, in philosophy. And him earning this PhD in philosophy in 1903 made him the United States' first Black PhD holder in the area of philosophy. And this is a man who I said had been enslaved as a youth in Virginia. And so these are the kind of stories that I want to bring to the forefront. And this is the kind of work that I've been like delving into the individual lives of people, Black people who, and I call it kind of being in the shadow of slavery, whether they were really enslaved themselves or the children of enslaved people or just contemporaneous with the institution of slavery. I want to make sure that those voices are heard and those stories are told.
Thanks a lot, Chaz. And my apologies to everyone for cutting out like that. We had some technical difficulties at home. Christy, could we hear a little about the work that you've been doing with the project?
Yeah, sure. So I was able to speak before. Here, but no, no problem. But pretty much to piggyback also like what you were mentioning, Charles. So there were definitely ministers that were speaking like about like the different indigenous folks and like the role that they as ministers had upon their lives. So when I think about like Reverend John like Sargent, he felt like it was his like duty to be able to go into these different lands and be able to pretty much Christianize them, kind of displace as well, bring knowledge and principles of Christianity. A lot of their ways he deemed as barbaric and insufficient, and he very much like, condemned their like drinking, and he also even like took in some of the two little boys of Captain Hunapot and Nungawat. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing it wrong, but like these are some of the role that he played in like trying to Christianize these people in their land. And I also think about like Eliezer Woolock, who also like he created a own like Indian charity school at Lebanon, Connecticut. And he pretty much believed that it was his role to educate these children. He believed that it was the duty to provide charity, quotations, he says, to those poor creatures, and they feeling that they're in need of Christianization. And he felt like it was the role of Christian denominations during this time period to unite and contribute to this cause. And this was in a text, it was that he wrote, and it was called A Plain and Faithful Narrative of the Original Design, Rise, Progress, and Present State of the Indian Charity School at Lebanon in Connecticut. So pretty much he kind of sent this out to kind of like get fundraising as well, but also to take the things that were going on. So these are examples of like different ministers that were coming out of Yale that were purporting these ideologies, these Christian ideologies, onto different people across the world and the implications of that.
Go ahead, please, Tiana.
I wanted to jump in really quick and follow up on Christy. You brought up Wheelock. Wheelock's Indian school actually goes on to become Dartmouth. And so the way Charles was mentioning, like a lot of these 18th century and later Yale folks are very important, not only in Yale's story, but really the New Haven. There's a lot of people who want to be justice of the peace or mayors, or, you know, are part of the governance of New Haven. There are people who go on to be involved in the state of Connecticut. There are people who go on to be a part of the signing of the, you know, the bill, the constitution in the early republic, who are part of the representatives. And then there are a lot of people who are involved in other educational institutions in the Hampton Institute, but also you know, Dartmouth, who are part of Brown, Columbia. All of these places are affected by Yale grads, Princeton, all of these places that really these people take their ideologies with them. And as far as the conversation on slavery, there are people who, especially in the early, or, you know, in the 18th century, who may be anti-slave trade, right, but are not anti-slavery. And maybe, you know, even if they hold those anti-slave trade sentiments, are not anti-racist. And you see this real need to differentiate in the 18th century, because, yeah, you have people who, yes, they made a school and they're trying to, you know, educate people, but it involves stripping natives or Africans of their culture and their identity, and this kind of imposition of European ideals. So it's nice to have counterbalances where you have Black people who are also, you know, educated, but also a part of the conversation for New Haven, or a part of the conversation for their own community, Native Americans who are part of their, you know, that conversation for themselves. And so really piecing out the different parts of the stories to get a full picture of how different people participated, and, you know, one anti-slavery, anti-slave trade, anti-race, these are not all the same thing. But yeah, Ebenezer Wheelock is one real interesting person, especially given all that he is involved in, and his many writings on, you know, how things should be.
Yeah. I also would say, like, in regards to, like, the anti-slavery, but not necessarily anti, like, racist and stuff, it kind of reminds me of, like, Samuel Hopkins, which a lot of people do, like, uplift for saying that, like, he agreed that, like, Black people should be free and shouldn't be in a state of bondage and stuff, but he's still very much held on to dehumanizing, like, language towards these individuals. He wasn't alive at the time for the American Colonization Society to have been created in 1817. But I definitely think he would have been a colonizationist, because he definitely has writings where he talks about that it'd be best suited for them to, like, return back to Africa. and such, and like, what should we do to be able to help them, Christianize them, to be able to do well in their native lands, pretty much. So though he was very much against like keeping them in bondage, and he thinking that it was wrong, and there's no way to be able to Christianize them and for them to learn the gospel and such if they continue to beat them, he still very much had language and ideologies that was still dehumanizing.
Now, I know that, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about the project here at Yale is that, you know, it doesn't end with emancipation. The research goes on well into the 20th century and you know, is looking as much at the legacies of slavery as it is about enslavement itself. And I know that that hasn't been your major area of focus. Maybe Chaz, maybe some with you, but could you just give a preview of some of the stories that are being uncovered about this continue, you know, that maybe people know a little about, but to put it in the context that this project is doing, I think would be useful to a lot of folks.
Sure, I can actually give you a story. And this is going to come to light not only in the written report, but in a program that we're going to be offering the Yale and Slavery Working Group in conjunction with Dixwell Congregational Church, of course, the Gilder Lehrman Center, focusing on some individuals who had a connection to Yale in the early days, some Black individuals, either as workers or early students. And the interesting thing about this conversation, the panelists will be descendants of these people. And so one family in particular really shows a through line with the Black experience in the early days of Yale from the late 1800s into the 20th century. And it really starts with a gentleman by the name of Charles McLinn, who was for 30 years, starting in about 1869, the college carpenter. And he ran the workshop at the university. And so Charles McLinn, of course, being there for 30 years, he makes all these wonderful relationships with students and faculty. And he had a bunch of daughters, and two of his daughters married two early Black Yale students, one who graduated from Yale in 1877, and then Charles McLinn's other son-in-law graduated from the medical school in 1883. And so that story doesn't stop with the family there. Charles McLinn's grandson, through another one of his daughters, actually attends Yale University in the early 1900s, and then goes on to become the first Black MFA earner at Yale University. And that guy's name was John McLinn Ross. So you have three generations of a family. And they have actually some other cousins who also attended Yale early on in the 1900s as well. But my point is, here you have a man who was born in North Carolina during the time of slavery. Now, he was not enslaved, but he was apprenticed out to learn a craft, and then moved here with a wave of folks from North Carolina to New Haven. But my point is, this man grew up definitely within a arm's reach of slavery. And in one generation, he has two Yale graduate son-in-laws, and then, you know, his grandson becomes a Yale graduate. So really, he starts this Yale dynasty, you know, walking out of the shadow of slavery.
Yeah, and I just to give a plug to the event that's coming up that deals with this. It's called Gleaming in the Shadow of Slavery, a Conversation with Descendants of African Americans of Old Yale. Going to be on Thursday, September 16th, 2021 at 7 p.m. And addition to the to the GLC, it's the Dixwell Congregational Church is one of the main sponsors, and I believe you're kind of moderating it. Is that correct, Charles?
Well, I'm on the panel. I'm not the moderator, but I will be present on the panel. But I, you know, since the research of the three of us on this conversation right now, you hear us talk back to the relationship between the church and the university. And with Gail, you're talking about the congregational church. And so there is this tie between Dixwell Church and Yale because it's a congregational church. And it is either the first or the second a black congregational church in existence. And this kind of, I would call it an experiment because the white, you know, kind-hearted liberal folks who helped to form and sort of nester the Dixwell Congregational Church, then went on to do the same thing across the United States and throughout the South when the slaves were freed. So you have schools popping up all over, whether they're become universities or colleges or like grammar schools. But a lot of these folks who did this work did so under the banner of the Congregational Church. And so there's this kind of weaved connection between the Congregational Church, Yale University, Dixwell Church, and other black congregational churches and institutions. And you see it, again, from like the 1860s well into the 1900s with philanthropy and even the pipeline of black students who eventually get the opportunity to start coming into the university do so through that relationship between Yale, the Congregationalists, and them working with the freedmen after the Civil War.
So do you think that, I mean, you've mentioned that relationship, but are there relationships as well between Yale and AME or VEREC as well? Because I know AME is, the Abyssinian Methodist Episcopal is doing similar kind of work during the Civil War and afterwards and bringing schools and that through the era.
Sure. I mean, there were other denominations that did that kind of work as well. Like you said, the Methodist Church did, the Episcopal Church took some swipes at it. The Baptist Church also set up schools Spelman and Morehouse were historically related to the Baptist denomination. White religion definitely wanted to have a hand in developing these freed black people. And part of that wasn't just out of like Christian duty, but the other part is about influencing minds and shaping people. If you get to be the maker of these people, then they're an extension of your operation. And you're growing, you know, your denomination or your brand, if you will. So yes, there are other relationships between church and developing the black community.
Some of the other legacies that the working group is uncovering are into the 20th century are the, you know, like the Klan at Yale, the way in which there's a concerted effort to kind of create connections between Southern students and Yale, so that story, you know, the recent changing of Calhoun College, it's not a surprise that it's named Calhoun in the 30s. There's a long kind of presence of that. So the story of Yale and slavery doesn't end with emancipation, certainly in that way. But I wonder if all of you could reflect a little on why the story is important to members of the Yale community and members of and the New Haven community, for that matter. Why, you know, why does this story matter today?
I'll go.
Okay, thanks, Jared.
I would say it matters because people need to know the truth. From a scholarly standpoint, if you really want to get the true lay of the land, then we really need to bring all parts of the story together. But it also shows you about like the truth of a people. You know, it's very important for everyone, particularly, you know, for African-Americans to know about their contribution, their sacrifice, and that they have a place at an institution like Yale that historically has been for the privileged and the wealthy. But it also makes an accurate depiction of what life was like what created the conditions of the institution of slavery, what slavery was like for people. It's not just like an academic study. It's the story of people's lives. And so I hope that people are inspired by some of these stories that come out. And I also hope that people understand that when you have privilege and power, it's your duty to make a way for people who don't have that kind of power and privilege. And I mean, the story is broad, the subject is broad, and there's so many important points that come out of this story, so many lessons.
Yeah, Christy, I know that the Div School has been doing a lot of work over the last years and kind of looking at its own history, but also acknowledging those leaders from the African-American community that have come through the Div School. I think they rename a room after Reverend Pennington, and there's a beautiful portrait in the room. Could you say more about some of the kind of actions and the reflection that's been going on at the Div School?
Yeah, sure. So I wasn't there during that time period for when the Div School was doing that type of work in regards to Pennington, since I'm relatively new to the school. However, I do know that they plan on doing an online exhibit detailing their relationship to slavery and such. I'm not on that committee, can't really speak too much as to what things are going to be done there, but I've heard that they're trying to do work. Nonetheless, in regards to your first question about why is this story important and such, and I just think that there's no Yale without New Haven, and there's Yale wasn't created in this bubble, and it just stays there. It very much had a lingering effect on people in the community, the nation, and the world. And we're very much still living in the aftermath of the residents of this institution and what it believed and what it continues to believe. And so I think it's important to kind of understanding of the history so we can see where this thread of ideology and philosophies come from and see how it continues to permeate today and to see how it has transformed in little ways to be able to fit during these times. Because I can definitely say the idea of these exploitations or these dehumanized languages and stuff like that is not something that has been relegated to the 18th and 19th century. It's very much alive today. And so in knowing that, we can be able to begin to tackle the different issues that are still alive and well in Yale and such, and pretty much to see, just to see the things that are still here and what work we need to continue to do, and not to just leave it as a research, but have actionable things that derive from this that is not just from Yale's perspective, but very much integrated with the New Haven community to see what exactly do they need. And since Yale as an institution in general is just we takes a lot from New Haven, and New Haven really much sustains Yale. So what can we do as learning this history? How can we learn that history, see what's going on today, to be able to do more so that people 200 years from now are not looking at our ideologies and philosophies that we are doing today and be like, wow, like they're still doing the same thing, like, but it just changed slightly. So I think that's why it's very much important, because it's affecting people's lives day to day. And yeah.
Thanks, Christy. Tiana, I know you're, all of you, and maybe you could speak for the others, are, you're not writing a report to end up on a bookshelf. Where would you like to see this project go from here?
I think for me, what I'd like to see from this project, and piggybacking off a lot of what Christy said, I'd really like to see, one, some kind of conversation or some kind of plan to give back to New Haven, especially in the 18th century. That move from Saybrook to New Haven was based on the idea that New Haven would be able to financially support Yale in a way, or support a college in a way that other parts of the state could not. So there's a lot in terms of how New Haven supported Yale financially. And so thinking about, you know, how much the seaport industry is very different now in the 18th century, that it was so robust, and it was so robust because of the slave trade with the West Indies. And then in the 19th century, you have other, you know, New Haven's still a pretty robust seaport, but it's not in the same way, because slavery will end in the British Caribbean. But it's still very important to financing. New Haven's role as a seaport is important to financing Yale and keeping it alive before you get like that really, those really big donations that are going to come, you know, in like the 20th century. Before then, you really got to rely on subscriptions from your local colonists. So thinking about, you know, sort of the conversations that can be had from this project, you know, can proceeds from the book or whatever go to the community or go to scholarships, thinking about Negro College that story will come out about the Negro College that never was because of Yale's role in blocking that and so essentially kind of blocking the first HBCU, but later on supporting the Hampson Institute. Like, you know, is there something to be said about Yale supporting, giving more to HBCUs, or, you know, to help with that, and thinking about its role there? And then besides that, thinking about education and curriculum, the history of Calhoun in particular, because he's right at the beginning of the 19th century, Calhoun's history and how he gets portrayed in his lifetime and then after his lifetime, Yale has a lot to do in whitewashing that and making that squeaky clean and eradicating slavery from that conversation and making him, propagating this idea of him as a great white man. And we don't need to talk about slavery. And things like that. And the sort of lost cause. And Yale was a part of promoting that ideology and sort of this idea that, oh, the Civil War has nothing to do with slavery. Like, Yale's a part of that. And thinking about what Yale can do now to, you know, correct that, and where Yale needs to be involved in the national conversation on education and the education of slavery, and putting that in the curriculum and the slave trade. Like, so there's a lot that the university could do, has done historically. And, you know, what this research is showing is very much that, you know, what I hope is that we can push the university to act now to correct some of its mistakes that we are uncovering, and then also to act in a more positive way towards New Haven, towards Black people, towards Native Americans going forward, to really, you know, sort of have some accountability, but also a change in direction and relationship to certain communities. So, yeah, hopefully this contributes to that.
Yeah, I think this is a great place to end things. Harry's giving me the sign off. And by the way, I really want to thank Harry Draws for all his work, and for getting me back online. And again, our best to Tom Ficklin. This is the Tom Ficklin Show. Just another Tom moderating today. Thanks so much for all of you. I do want to let you know that in October, the end of October, 28th, 29th, 30th, there's going to be an international, a conference on Yale and slavery that the Gilder Lehrman Center is doing. We're going to make it public, ideally, with people on benches and chairs taking part in it. But Certainly, it'll be available virtually for sure. We're hoping, fingers crossed, that we can get a venue that we can bring as many people who are interested in the subject. And thanks to all of you for the work that you're doing. And here's that we continue doing really this work of self-reflection and repair. I hope.
As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'ma roll with what I'm given. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going. Better go in the right direction. In the moment you stressing, but you gon' be counting blessings. And I know that for certain. Keep on working, open curtains. Haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. Whoa. I'm never gon' give up. Fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Cause this is my road, let's camera action, I'm ready to go. I'm never gonna give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Yeah, this is my road, let's camera action, I'm ready to go. Way too long, we faced them storms, now you gon' face the dawn you waiting for. I said from night to dawn, I write my wrongs alone, in competition with warnings, ice galore. Now I'm running toward it, my life's unfinished, being a quitter, but little by little, they joking, telling some riddles. Now I'm in my section, ain't willing to give up. Though you getting knocked down, but you gotta get up. I'm never gon' give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Cause this is my road, let's camera action, I'm ready to go. I'm never gonna give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Yeah, this is my road, let's camera action, I'm ready to go.